tantalizingly close to the Thwaites Glacier. That's the latest location update from our own Carolyn Beeler. She's on board the ice-breaking ship, the Nathaniel B. Palmer, in the waters off West Antarctica. The ship is finally bearing down on that glacier with a crew of scientists after an unexpected diversion. I spoke with Carolyn by satellite phone to get the latest.
So we are in the Amundsen Sea off the coast of West Antarctica, actually about where we were a week and a half ago. We're within less than a day of the glacier, and the ship is totally abuzz with excited scientists. They're hoping to get to an area in the sea in front of Thwaites Glacier that's completely unstudied. So this will be a new frontier for science.
Wow. You know, when we spoke to you a week ago, you were actually heading in the opposite direction, back north, away from Thwaites Glacier for a medical evacuation. How did that go?
It went fine. We made it back to the nearest base, back north, as you said, a British science base called Rothera that's located roughly halfway up the Antarctic Peninsula. There's an airstrip there where the person who needed medical care was airlifted to Chile. We're told the staffer's doing well, but we had to wait in the bay in front of that base for about 2.5 days while a replacement person got flown in. But the one silver lining is that we got to get off the ship and go on a tour of this research base to talk to some of the scientists. So I recorded a bit of that from after we got ferried in from our ship. So we just pulled up to Rothera, which is a base nestled in a giant mountain range. Some water with a bunch of icebergs.
So it's a really beautiful place.
My tour guide is Mary Sims, who's science coordinator here.
You see the mountains over there are part of the peninsula, and over the other side is the Larsen Ice Shelf. Okay, so we've just got to stop and look for any air traffic because this is our gravel runway.
As we walk along the runway, Sims tells me scientists here often fly out to nearby glaciers or ice streams for their field work. She says Rothera is the biggest of the UK's 5 Antarctic research bases, with something like 130 people.
Yeah, it's pretty busy.
Unlike research ships like the one I'm on, Rothera operates year-round, and Sims has overwintered 3 times.
And the sense of community, especially in winter, it's just 20 or so of you, and you're so kind of self-sustained. You're your own fire crew, you're your own medical crew, and everybody needs everybody.
Hi there.
Sims takes me to an office building where I meet Carl Robinson, who's just come back from an aerial survey of exactly the spot we're trying to go, Thwaites Glacier. It's a massive glacier that's a key part of the West Antarctic ice sheet.
Generally where we do airborne survey, it's normally big, flat and white, because basically all the instruments are very much tailored for looking and understanding what is actually beneath the ice surface.
But as Robinson flew over the crumbling front of Thwaites Glacier, he says he saw something very different.
A glacier following part would be the description.
We have been heading toward Thwaites to try to see that for ourselves. But here, scientists don't even have to leave the base to see ice retreating. Whew. Wind picked up a little bit.
Yeah.
As I walk back toward the dock to get back to our ship, I can see Sheldon Glacier off to my right. Scientist Mel Clark told me she's watched it recede from her office window here since her first field season at Rothera back in 2006.
It's really scary when you haven't been coming here that long and you can see glaciers going back. It's really scary in a very short period that these things are retreating.
And that's why we're heading toward Thwaites. This expedition that I'm covering is the first part of a 5-year effort to try to figure out how fast that huge glacier might start to break up and what that might mean for global sea level. So after we got to visit this research base, all the scientists were very glad to start moving south again later that afternoon.
Wow, it sounds like a beautiful place for those scientists to work. What's everybody been doing to keep themselves busy?
Well, there's been some science done on the ship already, so there's a bit of processing samples and looking at data. Otherwise, there have been science talks and paper reviews and people catching up on other academic work. But there have also been more creative efforts to keep everyone's morale high. So, for example, Anna Woolen, who is the scientist in charge of the new automated submarine on the ship, she's been teaching a group of us how to play bridge.
We must help each other to keep people's minds off the fact that we went for the wrong way for a little while. Now we are on our way back.
Other people have organized a ping pong tournament, which is nearing its final round, and even a sauna club.
How do you play ping pong if the ship is tilting?
It's just an added challenge, Carol. So the ping pong table is lashed down. And if the ship's moving a lot, you just have to kind of try to anticipate which way that's going to throw the ball.
You're learning all sorts of things out there.
More impressive ones than how to play ping pong on the high seas, I hope.
And I understand you've also taken time to answer one of the questions we've been getting from our listeners. The one you're answering this week came in from Ben, who listens to New England Public Radio in Amherst, Massachusetts. Ben wanted to know how wastewater and drinking water were handled on the ship.
It's a good question, and I ran around the ship a little bit to answer it, and here is what I found.
My name's Steven Bucher. I'm the first engineer on the boat.
Bucher's wearing a Red Sox hat, like he usually does. He brings me to a space below the main deck, about the size of a hotel room, that's filled with pumps and pipes. We're in the sewage room, so we're just off the engine room.
So, when you flush that toilet or your shower drains down, it comes down to these vacuum pumps into a holding tank.
From there, all the wastewater flows through a device that adds salt water and zaps it with an electric current.
There's an electrochemical reaction, which that salt water and the small electric current ends up turning into like a bleach, and it kills all the germs and all that stuff in the waste, pumps that into a settling tank. From there, it pumps it overboard.
So our wastewater gets cleaned and pumped back out into the ocean, and then we actually pump ocean water in to make drinking water, which is what we're going to go see next. Bucher walks me through the engine room to point out two desalination devices, each with a large silver drum. But all four engines are running down here, and it's too loud to talk. So in his workshop, he explains how the ship makes about 4,000 gallons of drinking water a day from seawater.
So we take the heat from our generators to warm up all that salt water. As that starts to boil up under a vacuum, gets collected up top in a condenser, which then just gets pumped through all our filters and then back up into the tanks.
Great. Steven, thank you so much for the explanation.
Yeah, not a problem.
It's interesting, Carolyn. How long can this ship sustain itself out there?
I don't know exactly. There is about a 6-month supply of food on the ship, and they do keep about 20%, I've been told, of fuel in reserve in case that's needed. So they do like to be prepared for any eventuality.
The World's Carolyn Beeler. She'll keep us updated as the ship approaches its destination, and she'll answer your questions about the ship's mission to research climate change on Antarctica. You can send an email to myworld@theworld.org. That's myworld@theworld.org. The Nathaniel B. Palmer is an icebreaker, and Carolyn shot a time-lapse video of the ship churning through sheets of thick ice. We've got that on Twitter at @PRItheWorld. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.